When I was many years ago, I was letters with Ajahn Tignano, the long thin French monk, and about metta meditation, and he was one of my great mentors, and was the conduit which put me in touch with Ajahn Mahachachai and taught me how to do metta meditation. And so one of the letters I was writing to him, just as a little kind of byline, I put a little quote at the end of the letter, all you need is love, and then just signed that and sent it off to him. And and I got this very stern reply back again saying, no, not all you need love, all you need is metta jhanas, plural. Which is a kind of interesting kind of take on the different attitudes to these things. we have there's this kind of dichotomy in Buddhism between sometimes our spiritual, we get a very kind of spiritualized idea of what these things are. It's a very high and very refined idea of these things, and then we've got an everyday kind of reality to them as well. That's when there's quite an interesting book called Not Where I Started From. It's a kind of a series of shorts. Anyway, she sort of went through this whole kind of spiritual cycle and then did all these kind of things and so on and so forth. And then at one stage she ended up as a nun in Burma, one of the Burmese meditation centers. I can't remember which one. Anyway, then she was one time when she was there was this little kitten came to the past the kitchen where the nuns were preparing the food or something, and she used to put out a saucer of milk for the little kitten, and then for doing that she got scolded by one of the senior nuns who reminded her that she was supposed to be practicing for her own liberation. And not to get distracted by these things. So obviously that's a kind of interesting perspective on what spiritual practice is about. So sometimes, certainly I know for myself, that doing metta meditation, trying to develop loving kindness, is usually extremely easy if nobody's around. And if you go back to your kuti and you're by yourself and there's no one to annoy you, then it's so easy to have metta for everyone, it's going to feel nice. But when you actually meet them and have to relate with these incredibly annoying individuals, it's a bit more challenging sometimes. And so of course the whole message or the whole point about this thing in Buddhism is that the one leads to the other, or that the two things are integrated, the two aspects. You know, we have a kind of everyday aspect to our practice. So I hate this phrase, practicing daily life. What other kind of life is there? Daily life, weekly life, practicing hourly life, I don't know, daily life, I don't know. I don't know any better word, but I just hereby register my protest against the use of the term daily life. Anyway, so we have our practice in daily life, and then we have the more kind of specialized, exotic, elite, refined meditation practices, which of course most of us, most of the time, only spend a minority of our the hours of the day actually doing those practices. And if we're on retreat, then we might spend a period of time where we're doing mostly meditation. And so that's good. outside of the retreat time, then meditation is usually a smaller part of the amount of time in the day, and the daily life is the greater part. Obviously, we want to try to develop these things in an integrated way. And it's kind of curious that it is possible, to some extent, to separate these things. And, you know, I've heard plenty of stories from people who say they can do this, who may be even, you know, quite stressed or neurotic or confused or something like that, but then can still be find a level of peace in their meditation. On the other hand, there might be people who are very, you know, very grounded and balanced and positive and all those kinds of things in their everyday life. But in their daily life, I'd be really thrilled if someone can give me a suggested term I can use instead of that, but whose meditation is rubbish. This also happens. And perhaps, you know, we kind of we kind of think that maybe it shouldn't be like that, but it is. That's just an empirical fact. If you don't believe me, just ask around a few people and ask how their meditation's going and things like that, and then you learn that that's actually how it is. So, of course, that's simply a way of expressing or saying that, that for most of us, our spiritual development is not yet mature and fully integrated. Obviously, we would expect and sort of aim for a situation where these things are integrated fully. And what we'll tend to find is that if, for example, if we have unresolved conflicts, if we have issues that we're trying not to look at, etc., etc., then we maybe can go away and do some intensive meditation or whatever and surmount these things to a certain degree. We can kind of keep them in the background and lift up our practice, lift up our mind over the top of them, but they're still kind of gnawing away in the background. And so what we find is that meditation tends not to be very stable. You have a good meditation for a period of time and then it will disintegrate. And this is one of the things that I found when I was early years of my practice, is that it was quite interesting because the first retreat I did was one of the most intensive, and still is perhaps the most intensive retreat I've ever done. And, you know, like 4 days of, you know, a whole month of meditating like 14 hours a day, and then at the end of it 4 days of just meditating constantly without any sleep for 4 days. It doesn't get much more intensive than that. And so you get sort of states of mind and states of consciousness which are quite you know, quite bright and quite profound and so on through meditating so much. And of course that all falls apart, and then you go and you meditate again and it comes back and so on and so forth. And so what I found is that, you know, your meditation practice isn't so much like it's not like an obvious and steady progression where it just keeps on getting better and better and better. Actually, it just keeps on getting up and down and round and changing in all kinds of ways. But what I did notice is that over a few years that the it became a lot smoother, the difference between, say, retreat time and not retreat time became less, the ease of going into the meditation and developing became greater, became more natural and fluid. And so that and then going into the retreat would be a more kind of fluid process, and then also emerging from the retreat, that, you know, you didn't have that feeling of kind of desperation as you, everything you've worked for is crashing around you after a day or two. So, and I think that the reason for that sort of increased sort of smoothness or fluency is because of you know, an improvement or an increased kind of integration between these two aspects. In other words, the way of using the mind outside of meditation, outside of the retreat time, becomes more in conformity and in agreement with how we're using the mind in the meditation itself. And of course, that doesn't mean that we're using the mind in the same way, okay? And this is another big mistake which a lot of meditators make, is that they try to use their mind in the same way out of meditation as they do in meditation. And that's not the right thing to do, okay? And, you know, just use an analogy by doing some kind of physical training. If you're you know, trying to become a trained to be a swimmer or something like that, then you know, you don't get in the pool, you swing your arms around and kick your legs and so on. That's what training is when you're in the pool. You don't get out of the pool and keep on swinging your arms and kicking your legs while you're making yourself a bowl of cornflakes in the morning. Yeah, it's just be silly. But this is what meditators try to do. They try to do the same thing when they're making a cup of tea as they do when they're sitting watching their breath. And it just doesn't work like that. So, of course, the mind is still the same, basically. It's still working the same way, but we're using it in different ways in different contexts. Now, the kind of foundational practices we do, saying in a community and in our daily lives, is mainly, or is, you know, where we want to get orientated on the, especially the early aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, and that is the right view. And the right view in that case is concepts. Okay, so you have like a conceptual framework, which is true in a kind of limited sense of being true, as we were discussing before the talk this evening, that the Buddha warned explicitly against anyone, you know, claiming to know the truth, or literally uses the word coming to a conclusion, niktaṃ gacchati, coming to a conclusion about what the truth is, who hasn't actually seen it for themselves. So, you know, if you haven't seen it, then you say, well, this is my belief, or this is, you know, this is what I think the case is. And so we try to work out, have our right view that sees things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And yes, it seems reasonable. It seems, it makes sense. And we can keep investigating that. That's not something that's kind of there, stuck for all time, but something we need to keep on investigating and which needs to keep on changing and growing. I think that's something that is important to remember, that right view is fluid also. In a sense, there are certain things which are you know, giving a pattern or a perspective to that. You know, we look at the Buddha's teachings. We have the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and impermanence and rebirth and all of these kinds of things. So they form the basis of it. But then our relationship to that, how we understand it, how we integrate it, what perspective, what's the emphasis, all of those things will change and hopefully deepen over time. And so, you know, this is part of our practice in everyday life, and we need to use that. And, you know, we do use it, and sometimes it becomes a bit of a joke. So, you're out there carrying rocks around or something like that, and you slip over in the mud or something like that, and somebody says, oh, well, life's meant to be suffering or something. And you kind of joke about it, yeah? And or, you know, you make something and then it breaks apart, and then you say, oh, well, it's impermanent then. And so the truths of Buddhism become worn out. And this is actually something which I think is very important to understand. And one of the things that tells us, you see, if you look at the Buddhist scriptures, you know, you look at, say, something like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, Buddha's first discourse, and he taught the Four Noble Truths, and you've got this group of the five ascetics, and Buddha gives this teaching and tells them all about the Four Noble Truths and Anya Kondanya. It's the big shot. Becomes a stream enterer, not quite a hole in one. He's landed on the green. He's just needs a couple of putts, and he's in there. And that's how powerful that teaching is. It was a very startling thing. It was very fresh. Yeah. But we've heard that so many times that it becomes a cliche and it becomes a joke. These things, they get worn down. One can even see that through Buddhist literature, in the history of Buddhism, that even by the time of, say, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, where you've got all these kind of jokes about emptiness and not self and so on, and then the Sariputta knocks on the door of Vimalakirti and says, who's home? And then Vimalakirti, the Bodhisattva, of course, who is greater wisdom than Sariputta, is only a puny arahant. And then he says, Vimalakirti says, there's nobody home. And of course, nobody home, it's a joke. Yeah? It's like it's in the higher sense, it's empty and there's not self and so on. But of course, Sariputta, as he's sort of playing the clown in this particular sutta, or text, he sort of says, "What do you mean nobody's home? I can hear your voice." So he kind of doesn't get it. But what that one of the things that thing is showing is that even by that time, which was that particular text was written maybe 700-800 years after the Buddha, something like that. So even by that time, the truths had become so worn down that they became used, they were like something you played with, and they didn't have that same sort of gut impact that they had for the Buddha's first disciples. It's something you grow, they're not a startling revelation, it's something that you grow up with within a Buddhist community, and you've heard so many times that they kind of wash over you. So one of the things that this teaches us is that a right view cannot be static, okay? Because even if we in tone or incant or invoke the same truths again and again and again, it doesn't mean the same thing. It doesn't affect us in the same way. And so, for right view to be meaningful, there has to be some fluidity, there has to be an element of surprise there, an element of freshness. And so then there has to be that to keep that there, then we have to keep on investigating. And this of course is the problem, and this is why we have the word dogma, isn't it? We have the word dogma. Dogma means like a dried up, worn out truth that's just, you try to capture the truth in this kind of list of categories and sayings. And we know that from say Christian history, that you've got somebody like Jesus who comes with a very fresh message and sort of tells parables and stories and blows everybody away, and then that gets turned to these kind of dry and boring, awful dogmas. And of course, you had the same thing within Buddhism. You had the Buddha with his aliveness, his responsiveness to a context, his creativity in teaching. And then that all gets kind of abstracted and turned into this kind of lifeless, bloodless matrix of Abhidhamma categories, and endlessly debating literally about how many angels can fit on the head of a pin. I mean, this is this kind of classic thing in European history about the kind of the meaninglessness of the scholastic debates, but actually you find exactly the same debate in Buddhist history as well. I'm not sure if it's the head of a pin, but there's certainly how many devas can fit into something. I can't remember what they're trying to fit them into. And so we have to have that revolutionary approach that's going to blow all those things out of the water. And so this is where you have, of course, your Milarepas, your Bodhidharmas, your Ajahnmans, who will come along and blow all that stuff away and have a fresh insight into the Dhamma, a fresh, totally kind of bringing it alive again. So this is how we have to do that somehow. And so one of the ways that we do that is through, in our daily life, using it. And yes, we can still joke about it, that's okay, but also realizing that it's that in some sense it's still true, that it is suffering actually. And regarding and looking at the different aspects of what we're doing in these different ways. So, for example, say we can play with, say, the first noble truth and the second noble truth. Sorry, not the first noble truth. They throw the first factor of the path and the second factor of the path. So the second factor of the path being right intention. Okay, so right intention is like a more active and emotive aspect. Are we acting out of greed, hatred, and delusion? Are we acting with a sense of renunciation, giving up? Are we acting with a sense of kindness, trying to help, and so on and so forth? So you can actually do that. You can actually kind of play with those different perceptions. So you can, for example, if you're doing some work in the monastery, then you can reflect, oh, well, this here I am giving up. I'm giving up my time. I'm acting out of generosity and kindness. And then that can bring you a great sense of joy. Yeah, you do use it for developing that kind of positive emotion. But then once you've got the positive emotion there, then you can think, but it's all suffering anyway. Yeah? And then you look at it on the side of suffering. Yeah? So these are two quite different perceptions. And if you play with them in this way, yeah, even just alternating between the two different perceptions, then you realize how conditional they are. You don't get trapped into it. Actually, you can see exactly the same thing from the two different ways, and neither one is absolutely true. When we investigate like that, then through seeing things in different ways, sometimes it will depend on the different mood in the mind. So sometimes mind has this kind of natural sense of nibbida, natural sense of wanting to let go, and there'll be like a it's kind of sober sadness. It's a term that Ajahn Jayasaro used, sober sadness, melancholy. This was Ajahn Jayasaro's favourite emotion, was melancholy. He's a poet. And so you kind of get this, and this kind of feeling of well, you know what I mean. You know what melancholy feels like. And then when that's there, when that kind of emotional perspective is there, then things will seem in that way. Yeah? And you kind of look at them and you see that actually it's all suffering. Yeah? You feel a distance from people. You look at how what people are doing, their motivations, their actions. Why does she say that? You know, God, it's so boring. Oh, God. And then, you know, why is it? And then it kind of on and on, and you're just sort of turning away and just sort of really withdrawing from that. And that's like one perception, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's quite useful, actually. What's wrong with it is getting stuck in it. If you get stuck in it and goes too far, then it'll turn into depression, and then that's no good. But having it as just a part of the moods or changing of the mind, there's nothing wrong with that. And then at another time the mind will be very happy and positive, you'll be very bright, and then you feel like you can do anything. You feel this tremendous confidence and energy, and you can undertake anything and do anything. And so that's it's just another mood. Yeah, so it's suitable for acting in a different way, but that too will pass. So we kind of watch all these things happening and watch the rhythm of them. If we see that they are changing in a kind of a gentle and natural way, then that's good. That's fine. Then we just kind of go with that flow, and use it in what seems the best way at the time. If it's alternating or changing in a way that's too erratic or dysfunctional or it's confusing or that we can't understand and so on and so forth, then that's a sign that we need to do something about it. We need to try to work with it to dampen the cycles or to stop our mind from going into extremes, and so on and so forth. So this is our wisdom that's discerning this. It's discerning, what is the nature of the kind of the emotional changes in the mind, and so on and so forth. So it's quite natural that sometimes we'll feel disenchanted and disillusioned, and we'll feel just kind of wanting to withdraw, and maybe we want to just stay in our heart, stay in our kuti, and just feel very comfortable there, feel very happy just to be alone and don't want to come out and see anybody. And so that's okay, and just do that, be there for that time. Other times we feel like we want to engage and so on and so forth. But the important thing is that we don't buy into these changing moods. They're just moods, that's all. Just let them come and go, and don't kind of impose them on others. So we're not kind of projecting them on others and pretending that others are the source of these things, and that other people have to change themselves to fix our moods up or how we think up. This is not skillful, not wise. Our moods and things is our own business. We'll look after it. When we're living and practicing, then these two things, these two aspects, right view and right intention, they're like the mental, psychological, cognitive basis for our behavior. And of course that's expressed in the Eightfold Path with the right speech, right action, right livelihood. So what we actually do, how we are with others, how we talk to them, is of course conditioned by our mind. Our speech comes out of our mind. Our actions come out of our mind. So if that is dysfunctional, so if our relationships with others breaks down, if we can't communicate, if we feel that there's something that needs to be said and can't be said, all of those things, then something's wrong. Okay, so something's wrong with our right view or our right intention. You know, we're not understanding things in the right way, or else we're emotionally clouded and coming from maybe from selfishness rather than. And these things can become great bogeymen in our minds. We can build up structures, thought patterns, ideas about others, which really hasn't got much to do with them themselves. And this is like the flip side of what I mentioned earlier when I said that you can sometimes have a nice time and be relaxed and happy and so on when you're by yourself, and then find it much harder to deal with people. But also the other way around also happens as well. And sometimes when you're by yourself, you can you build up an idea in your mind about another person. You build that idea up through your thoughts, memories, perceptions, and you reify that. It becomes more and more true for you and more simplified. And that idea is, of course, your product. It's not them. It's entirely a factor of your consciousness. So, you'll be sitting there talking to that construct in your mind which you imagine to be that other person. And what is this but sheer delusion, of course? Yeah. And then the emotions that we generate by doing that, we talk to that person in our minds, we generate certain emotions around that, and then we act towards the actual person when we meet them with those same emotions, as if that person, that flesh and blood person who has their own mind, their own thoughts, their own feelings, as if they are nothing more than a projection of our own consciousness. So this is all a bit kind of sad and a bit unnecessary. when we are talking like that, and we're talking with somebody as like a third person in our mind, you know, you should understand what that means or reflects in a psychological sense. Of course, what you're actually talking to is you're talking to an aspect of your own mind. But you're talking to an aspect of your own mind which you've cut out from yourself, cut out from your center, and which you're treating as the it. So there's the it, the thing. Okay? And because our thoughts are linguistic, okay, we tend to think in terms of language and use grammar and so on, then we have like a third person where we're, you know, you're thinking about that person. They did this, they did that, they did the other, yeah? He did this, she did that, he said that, and so on and so forth. And so in that case, this person is like the third person. They're completely separate, and you've got no involvement with them, whatever. So that's telling you that there's actually this part of your mind is completely cut off. You've completely cut that off. You've externalized that, and you're creating that externalization through the use of your thought in this way. And then you have like the other as the second person. The other as the second person is the thou or the you. And so this is where you're actually talking with somebody. So when you're actually talking with somebody, then they're not as separate from you, okay, as if it's he, she, it. Right? You're actually face to face with them, even if you're only face to face in your own mind. You're at least able to engage with them. So there's a dialogue between what you see as yourself, your center, and what you see as the image you carry about the other person. And those things are in a dialogue. They're actually engaging with each other. So that's at least a bit better, even if it's still delusory. But then wisdom takes those things, and when wisdom with mindfulness, you look at it and you say, actually, this is just me. Here I am. I'm sitting alone in my kuti. There's nobody around. I can't hear any other sights. I can't hear any other sounds, any people. I can't see anybody. I'm having a conversation with my own mind. This is it. This is what's going on. And then our wisdom sees that, and it brings it all back into the center, and you realize, actually, it's just me. And when you look at that, then it's actually quite profound. You're actually seeing how we're creating these images of others, and then we kind of read those images into them when we meet them, and so on and so forth. And so one of the sure signs of wisdom is the ability to not engage with that whole process. And then by not engaging in it, what that means is that when you're dealing with your own mind, then you understand that as your own. You see, this is my thoughts, these are my feelings, this is my projections, these are my ideas, this is my memories, this is my perceptions. This is me. This is what's going on here and now. And I need to understand these as aspects of my own mind. And then when we meet with others, so when we have like that external engagement with them, and you say good morning, and they say good morning, then that is fresh in that moment. That good morning that you say is an act of reaching out towards another. That's an act of saying, I want you to be happy, or I bear goodwill for you. I want to engage with you in a way that's positive and reassuring and supportive. And when they say good morning back to you, then that's sending the same message, saying, oh, thank you for that. Yeah? Even though maybe we were arguing yesterday, and maybe this thing happened or that thing happened, but still today is a fresh day, today is a new day. And in a sense, we have never met before. This moment has never happened before. This moment is happening right now. And this is not as we meet, as two human beings meet, in we create a new thing, we create a new entity. There's a new space there. There's a space between two people when they talk that's created. And that space never existed before. And within that space there are two minds, two consciousnesses, two bodies, two people who are aware with each other and are involved or engaged with or interact. And so this is a new opportunity for our minds to grow and to share. So that will only last for a short time and then it's gone. Yeah? And so that's also something to be mindful of. That moment is never there again. We only have one chance to live it. And so let's do our best to live it well. Let's do our best to not have things that we would regret. One of the most powerful or profound things that I ever heard was when I attended the funeral, did the funeral service for Kapa and Nalini's daughter. And as many of you may know, she died very suddenly. She gave birth, had a cesarean, gave birth, and then had this very, very strange and rare immune system reaction, so that she just gave birth, was able to hold the baby just once. And then this immune system reaction set in and her organs just packed up one after the other, and the doctors literally couldn't do anything, just sat around and watched, and she died very soon after that. And so of course everyone was very shaken by this, and I went to did the funeral in Melbourne, and the husband was so shaken that he couldn't give a eulogy directly, but he'd written something and somebody read out the eulogy, and in that he said that if his wife, who he loved so much, was able to come back, or if he was able to spend another 5 minutes with her before she died, and then he was thinking, what would I say to her? What would I say if I only had that 5 minutes left? And then he thought about that and said to himself, I wouldn't have anything to say. There is nothing that we need to say. So this is I found that very, very profound, very powerful statement. And so I think this is a very, very wonderful guide for us to, if we want to really, really be able to be in the community in a very beautiful way, to keep that in mind all the time. So that every encounter we have with every person is always like that. It's always I'm thinking, if this is to be the last time that I ever meet with this person, am I going to leave any unfinished business? Am I going to regret anything? Am I going to wish that there was something that I'd said? And if we can keep our relationship and engagement with people at that level of mindfulness, that level of freshness, and that level of honesty, our hearts will become very, very light. And when our hearts become light like in that way, then our meditation will go very, very smoothly. And so just as in our meditation, each thought, each feeling, each movement of the body, each breath in and out, we try to greet as something new and fresh and try to see it as it is in its immediacy. And then that brings that lightness to the mind, and our meditation is always a kind of that lightness, the fresh dawn arising. Every moment is like that fresh dawn, a sense of like joy and exploration about the present moment. It's always new. There's always something to be learnt from it. If our mind is like that, carries that, then that integration between the quote-unquote daily life and meditation will happen naturally. You know, there won't be a conflict between those things. We won't be thinking when we're out of meditation. We will find a joy in that. When we come into the meditation, we also find the joy in that. We won't find a conflict between the two. So this is my little talk for you this evening on meditation and practice in daily life. What an awful title for a talk, anyway. So I offer that to you for your reflection and edification.